Well, I was hoping to bring along that first letter that Paul answered me. It was in, we both wrote in longhand. It's in a file of older correspondence that I couldn't reach for in time. It's somewhere in the basement, but it's of the building. But anyhow, I remember something of what he said. I mean, I had asked him several questions about his work and said I was working on another way of doing it. And I thought that he'd be interested. And I remember he said something like, "Dear Dr. Stockmeyer, your letter brings up several nettling questions connected with gelation theory," or something like that. I remember he used the adjective nettling. And he made comments on them. One of the things that I was concerned with was unequal reactivity of the groups, something I never went back to myself. Manfred Gordon is the guy who really fixed that one up years later in England. But he said that he'd be interested in hearing about my method, and why didn't I come over? And he was then in Linden, New Jersey, at Esso Labs. And so I don't remember if there was any telephoning involved or not. By this time, you know, too, this was all research done on the side, because we'd got into the war in December of 41, and the first assignment, aside from teaching classes, which were still around, was to work for URI with George Kimball on the deuterium exchange equilibria, because heavy water was still in the picture.
So that was taking up most of your time during
More, anyhow. So I can't put a date on the meeting with Florey. Must have been sometime in 1942, though. And when I got over there in Elizabeth, I went to his office. He showed me the bank of osmometers. He was measuring the osmotic pressures of polyisobutylene, that very famous paper of his on the osmotic pressures of and viscosities of polyisobutylene. What stands out about it was how accurately his data followed a Mach-Hellink law with a fractional exponent, 0.64, something like that, over about three decades of molecular weight. He'd gone from about 3,000 molecular weight to 2 million fractionated, and he did this all with his own hands, I think. Well, he had maybe one assistant. And the theories up to that time had sort of said, it's got to start out first power and end up square root or something like that, but here was the damn thing just on a log-log plot. It was really straight for three decades, and that's a lot. So he was doing that, and then he called me in the office and asked me to start showing him what I had been doing. I started writing on the board, and after a while he said, "Wait a minute." Then he went in the next lab and talked to John Rayner, R-E-H-N-E-R, a man with whom Florey later worked on the theory of rubber elasticity and swelling of networks. He said, "John, come in here. I want you to hear this too." And so Rayner came in, we were introduced, and then I gave my spiel again. Had lunch, and I don't remember much else, except he said, "That's very interesting. Go ahead and write it up, why don't you?" And so I did, and then a little later we had this, I say, disagreement, which did not lead to unpleasant relations. As you know, in later years, Florey was often an extremely bitter opponent of people who didn't agree with him. I said I didn't see how the way he handled things after the jump point was passed could be right, because it seemed to put cycles in like he had assumed there weren't any to begin with. He sort of thought physically that was closer to the truth than what I was doing, which is to say, well, I'll just keep the rigorous condition that there can't be anything but trees all the way, and they do give different answers. Mm-hmm. Well, physically, he was better than I was. Mathematically, maybe I could do mine rigorously. His is a sort of strange ansatz, but it also leads to a definite result. And it's far easier to apply to more complicated systems than mine would be. So I think on balance, we each had a little something that we could say, and years later, many people went back and investigated under what conditions you'd get one or get the other. And I guess the real problem is still not completely solved, namely how much ring formation is there, because that depends on real conformational problems too. But so I wrote it up, and of course I think I had enough decency to thank him, and I certainly thanked the mayors. And there was this joke when I came around to handling more complicated cases when Harris Mayer had gone to work for Joe, and I don't know what has happened to Harris Mayer. He disappeared into the Manhattan Project, and he certainly never finished a PhD with Joe Mayer afterwards, either at Columbia or Chicago. But Mayer, and Stockmayer, we just thought that would have been real funny, but they didn't think that was such a hot idea.
Yeah, well.
No, and I even remember going in and saying, don't you guys want to put your names on this one? And they said, no, you did. I mean, I said, you helped me. I mean, Maria especially sat with me a few hours. No, you publish it alone. So I did.
Well, that...
They were wonderful people. We even lived in their house. They went off to a Nantucket or somewhere for a week, and my wife and I were living in a hot apartment right near the Columbia campus, and in exchange for mowing the lawn a couple of times, we were allowed to go and live there for a week out in Leonia, which was maybe 4 degrees cooler than the city.
Probably felt good.
Yeah.
Had you had any other contacts with people in polymers outside of the group at Columbia and Florey at this time?
No, I never. Well, except Charlie Beckman. Yeah, I mean, on the same floor. Here, Charlie had an ultracentrifuge, and there were 3 students working on problems on starch derivatives, physical chemistry of, with the ultracentrifuge plus osmometry as a tool. And their names were Ralph Dunlap, who went later to Monsanto, had an industrial career, Hugh Bryce, who later went to 3M, had a good career, and Tom Fox, about whom you know a great deal. So I was friendly with all those guys, and used to go bowling with some of these characters as well as talk chemistry.
Did you? Was there any travel back and forth on the subway to Brooklyn at this time? You know, with Mark's group in.
Not all the way to. No, the first contact with Herman Mark that I remember is actually at the. A nice symposium that the New York Academy of Sciences ran. That was before they got their building on the east side, and so this meeting was in the Museum of Natural History. And it was quite a good meeting. Florey was there and gave his Florey Huggins paper there, as I recall. Eyring was there, Charlie Price, Mark. I can't remember them all, but I went to those papers, all of them, and Charlie Beckman gave one too, as I recall. So I think he got me to go.
Was that in 42?
42, yeah. I certainly got over to Brooklyn at least once then, but see, Doty and Zim didn't finish till after I'd left for MIT again. He had some sort of a signal as to how non-valuable my efforts to win the war were. There was no difficulty in, you know, I was never a full-time Manhattan district employee, and going back to MIT didn't disrupt the allies and when at all.
Well, how did you come to go back to MIT then?
Well, I was asked to go back and become an assistant professor. They needed me, and by this time Keyes had been encouraged, let's say, to step down as chairman, and Hamilton was acting chairman. Cope was still a year away from coming as chairman. That was only after the war was over, 2 years later. And they wanted me to help teach the Navy students, and they thought they had some more work that I could do which would be good. After one abortive look at a project that turned out, I thought, not to be worth doing or appropriate, I hooked up with von Hippel. The other one was by an industrial sponsor, and it was actually, I would call it post-war or hedging for the post-war situation rather than war research. And as soon as I recognized that, I got out of it, but I don't want to describe what or who it was or anything. And von Hippel was another inspiring fellow, a man from Göttingen, and of course, like Maria Mayer, whom he knew from, I guess they were both Göttingen children.
So was that taking up most of your time in that, the war-related work?
Whatever there was, yeah, pretty much.
Because you still did find time to publish the paper on branch chains then, with, the second paper.
That was finished at Columbia, essentially. I wrote it up after I'd gone back, but yeah, in fact, there's a chemically irrelevant personal story on that. I was doing the last derivation, and I was proud of that paper because of I never had a formal course in complex variables in mathematics, but I used some Cauchy tricks on that in there that seemed to work, but I finished them the morning my first son was born. And I'll tell you how that was. I mean, my wife started in labor about 4 a.m. and we got in a taxi and took her up to Presbyterian Hospital. And I asked, of course, should I stick around? Oh, no, it'll be hours. Go away. Don't come back before 11 a.m. I said, are you sure? Oh, absolutely. So I went down to the lab, but I couldn't go back to sleep, and I finished a couple of derivations, and then I went back up there on schedule. Baby had been born an hour before, and where the hell was Daddy? it's something you never quite live down, and I haven't really, I think. My wife understood, but at the same time she didn't, why wasn't I there? This was long before fathers were encouraged to hang around and watch deliveries. Yeah. They were simply not welcome.
Yeah, well, that happened to my father and me, so I can appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah. But anyhow, that's that paper. No, and there was one other one that I did a couple of things in spare time. The copolymer paper, based on, you might say, a simplification of Simha's general result that he didn't do much with, and then there was a paper on SO3, which was a sideline, and that was entirely a result. Of course, the first time I ever taught statistical mechanics myself, it was still in the war, but there were about two or three students, George Cavanaugh and Harold Mickley, and maybe one other guy, and Mickley became a chem engineering prof. Said, gee, the other day with Doc Lewis, we wondered about the heat capacity of SO3. I don't think anybody ever measured it. We'd just been talking about calculating thermodynamic functions from spectra. And he said, suppose we could try that? I said, I'll think about that. And I came in the next day. I said, okay, throw away the rest of the problem assignments for the term. You guys are going to do this instead. And so it turned the course into a little research. There were only two of them by this time. The third guy, I can't remember even who that was. But so instead of formal lecturing by me or anything, we just all worked together on that. And it worked out, at least temporarily, okay. I think in the end, some of our interpretations of the rather crude spectra were wrong. It was the best estimate of the thermodynamics of SO3 for quite a few years, so it was good for the students, too.
the I wonder if we, well, we'll come back to some of your work with Zim and other research. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about what the chemistry department at MIT looked like just after the war, and how things were changing. You began at MIT when it was really the end of an earlier era.
Yes, that's right.
In the post-war period, not only did things change at MIT, but things changed nationally in terms of the support of research and.
Yeah, well, that was beginning. The Office of Naval Research, of course, was the first granting agency before NSF. NSF didn't get established till what, 50? Yeah. ONR was going a bit earlier than that. Well, as far as MIT was concerned, of course, I just loved it anyhow as a sort of home by this time, plus the fact they'd also hired Dick Lord, R.C. Lord, to come into the lab, so we had a molecular spectroscopist. And so I could teach the kind of courses I enjoyed thinking of teaching, at any rate. And with Lord as another colleague, the older tradition of, well, Thurman and Beatty was still there. Gillespie had died. Keyes had essentially retired. He was still around, but he didn't teach anymore. Scatcherd was still very vigorous and moving into more contact with the Harvard medical people, so proteins, quasi-polymers, and so that, I'd always gotten along well with George Scatcherd, and so that was a temptation, and indeed there was Slater still around, and not that I had any contact with him anymore. Oh, in fact, I guess the physicist who next really gave me a real important hand up was Tissa. I'll come to that when we discuss the light scattering paper.
Did you... Were you aware of it, or did you, looking back on it, do you feel that there was a real change in the atmosphere for research at MIT in that sort of from 45 to...
I do, yeah, uh-huh. And, Compton had brought it at an earlier era to the Institute as a whole, and of course it arrived in physics sooner, and with the change of administration in the chem department with the advent of Cope, it happened in chemistry. Of course, he brought in some brilliant organic chemists very quickly, young colleagues, namely Jack Roberts and Gardner Swain and John Sheehan. The older guard in organic wasn't particularly happy about that. In fact, several of them, I think, had fancied themselves as possible chairman of the department when Cope was brought in from outside as well. But suddenly organic, which, well, hadn't been anything special at Tech, had, some really able young practitioners. Cope was not all that old himself. Mm. And I'd known Art Cope at Columbia, you see. He came to Columbia from Bryn Mawr as an associate professor when I was there as an instructor, so we knew each other at Columbia already. When war, he went off to, what was it called, OSRD, Office of Scientific Research and Development, yeah. And then ended up at MIT, but we were already friends. Mm-hmm. And I thought, he was chairman for 20 years, and I thought for about the first 15 he did a great job. And then it didn't go so well anymore, I thought.
Well, about the time you decided to go to Dartmouth? Or?
Had something to do with it. It wasn't an out-and-out saying, hell no, but... I mean, I was going stale anyhow, but this didn't contribute to my wish to stay. So, big change at MIT. The students after the war were so damn good. I mean, there were so many of them. They were older and wiser and more experienced than the average graduate student. They were the people who had been in the armed forces and coming back for grad work. And classes were challenging, and they were good students, so it was an exciting time to be teaching anywhere.
And you, well, you picked up some of your early grad students at that time, too. Jacobson is one.
Well, Jacobson was another Columbia guy. I already had him at Columbia.
Oh, that's right. That's yeah. Because that,
he was a
that
little,
paper had been
published Homer later. Jacobson was also a young star. He was 18 years old. Was it 18? Or maybe I exaggerate a little bit. Yeah, it must have been 18. He graduated from Caltech already and came to Columbia, or maybe 19.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was. I forgot that was just a paper that was delayed in publication, but it was.
Yes, that's right. Well, it was delayed because the two advisors were myself and Charlie Beckman, neither of whom is a real whiz-bang in getting things out on time.
And that was part of the stuff on intramolecular reactions.
That's right. Yeah, the ring formation thing, which is still useful, and oh, it's been greatly improved. But
mm-hmm. Well, the next big topic you took up was, in addition to with Zim, you continued working on the same kind of problem in polymers, namely, in this case, dimensions of polymer chains.
Well, that was, Bruno was out of Berkeley. I mean, he and I had been friends when he was a grad student with Joe, but there was no direct working together then, although we tried something when he was in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and I was at MIT. He was already thinking we'll use Joe Mayer's cluster expansion on the problem of two chains, the second virial coefficient. And he wrote a paper in 1946, which develops that, and which has a sort of plaintive acknowledgement at the end, saying that it was originally planned to write this paper in collaboration with Stockmeyer, but as he put it so genteelly, he said, the difficulties interposed by the distance between Cambridge and Brooklyn proved to be insurmountable. I mean, the fact is, the difficulties were that I had two young kids and didn't have enough gumption or energy to hold up my end of the bargain, that's all. So he, in the end, went it alone. Mm-hmm. But we talked about that a lot together. And then the first real collaboration came when he was in Berkeley, mm-hmm. and I was at MIT, and we just corresponded. And he said he'd been making these calculations about certain dimensions of some rings, and I said, gee, I've been doing some of that too. Well, so we exchanged what we'd done, and they dovetailed beautifully. Mm. He had done practically nothing of what I'd done, and vice versa. So we had a paper about twice as big and twice as full of results as either one of us might have had alone at that stage.
Yeah. And then shortly after that, you started, actually roughly around the same time, you started working on light scattering.
Yeah. Okay, now I'd like to talk about that because there's one especially human story involving Kirkwood. But of course, I'd started being aware of light scattering from early because of friendship with Paul Doty and Bruno Zim, correspondence or occasional visits, and the consulting with Fred Billmeyer, who was building a machine right at DuPont in Arlington and started measuring lucite and things like that and proving that the molecular weights were about 10 times as big as what they'd always thought they were. Mm-hmm. They used to use the Staudinger law. Staudinger had probably, or maybe they had done the work themselves, but Staudinger's old trick was to assume that things went, the intrinsic viscosity, assume it went exactly as the first power of the molecular weight, that was the Staudinger rule, and to calibrate it with one freezing point measurement on a rather low molecular weight sample. So, what you really have is a, can I?
Sure.
Right, you may have a curve that goes like that, some fractional power, this is intrinsic viscosity and molecular weight, not log-log plot, but really. What they would do is say it's got to be first power, and we'll calibrate it with that point there, and it goes through the origin, so here goes the line. And by the time you're up at the molecular weights you really have, you can see you can be off by a hell of a lot. And So the molding powder that DuPont made, Lucite molding powder, they'd always called it 15,000 molecular weight. When Fred measured it, it was 150,000. But it didn't matter to the guys in the plant or even to engineers. It's relative values that mattered. Both went up and down together. The viscosity is a fine relative index no matter what you think the absolute values are. No, but back to light scattering. So the reason I got interested in the multi-component problem was that John Edsel, friend of Scatcherd, and by now, well, friend of mine, I'd say, although we got more friendly years later, was beginning to work on protean solutions and to do decent light scattering on the protean to avoid nasty problems having to do with charges put in salt. So now you already have a three-component system, water, salt, protein. You might have a buffer in as well. Paul Doty had come to Harvard by now, too, and he was doing light scattering there. And when he arrived at Harvard, 48 or 49, he had a brief time at Notre Dame right after the war, after Brooklyn. But anyhow, so the problem existed, and there was nothing much in the literature until Debye published something with one of his own students named McCartney and with two U.S. rubber chemists. He used a consult at U.S. Rubber. Ewart, Rowe, Debye, McCartney. Mm-hmm. And they had done some light scattering and mixed solvents and found that you get the wrong molecular weight generally if you make believe the solvent isn't a mixed solvent and treat it like a single component. And they gave a non-formal, you would say, non-statistical mechanical, but more physical theory based on relative adsorption of one of the solvent components to the polymer, which is physically the right, completely the right idea. So their theory, as far as infinite dilution was concerned, was completely adequate. I mean, an equilibrium constant is as good as a free energy, as far as I'm concerned. They're different ways of saying the same thing. But more generally, you want to do it at a bunch of concentrations, and you'd like to be able to handle umpty components, so there was still something to be done. So I started out after that, and I think had the result by using sort of standard grand canonical ensemble, but it took me a long time to get around everything, and I'd been sort of socially friendly with Laszlo Tisza, a physicist, Hungarian, one-time co-worker with Teller and Göttingen, nothing like Edward Teller, a far more likable, if not quite so brilliant, human being. And Lotzi and his wife at that time, Vera and Sylvia and I, were friendly because of, well, just mutual interests of various kinds. And he was a real good theoretical physicist, and he suggested maybe I should try to fool around with different approach, since ultimately I wanted systems under constant pressure rather than at constant volume. When I tried, you know, there was a constant pressure ensemble. Guggenheim had written about that. And then I don't actually remember whether Lotzi also put the bee in my bonnet about what you could call a semi-grand ensemble, where you keep the number of moles of one component fixed but keep the potentials of the others fixed. Mm-hmm. So it's in the grand ensemble you use chemical potentials as the independent variables rather than the mole numbers. But this was sort of a bastard of the two. Mm-hmm. Whether the idea came from him or not, I do not know. I mean, again, I worked it out. He said no, he wasn't interested in being a co-worker on the paper, so I thank him in it. But this was the quickest road to what I wanted, and it's an ensemble that has survived and had some other uses. Well, Terrell Hill put it into his textbook and gives me credit for it, which perhaps Tissa should have had. I must say I'm a little hazy as to how all that went, except that he didn't want to be part of the paper. I do know that very recently Bob Alberti at MIT has found that he likes to use it in connection with some equilibrium problems of a series of homologous hydrocarbons. So, as a sort of formal exercise in statistical mechanics, it was interesting in its own right, or statistical thermo. It isn't really basic. It's just kind of a trick application. But the interesting, well, and so the results were available to Edsel already in 1948, but I was still having real literary constipation with the kids being young, and we'd bought a house out in Weston, old house requiring lots of attention, and a long commute to MIT, and I couldn't seem to get anything written.
Yeah. One second.